There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, Stephen, and there you have it. There you go.
Hello, this is Desiree for F1Weekly.com. I'm your in-depth correspondent.
Let's go with the qualifying, Steve.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Nasser Hamid, my co-host. This is podcast number 914, November 29th. 2021, Nasser.
Thank you, sir. I say Lewis of Arabia leading the revolt. Red Bull digging in deep in the desert sand. And Clark, just so you know, I am fighting the dreaded Florida winter. It's here now. Back to you, sir.
Thank you, Nasser. On today's program, who flinches first in Saudi Arabia? Frank Williams passes away at 79. LCH wants to be the purest F1 driver. And just a reminder, we need your contributions to keep this program up on the servers. So support F1Weekly.com by clicking on the front page. You know you want to. Also, if you want to receive updates to our podcast show, as well as occasional promotions and giveaways that are only announced via our email updates, just go to the front page, upper right-hand corner, add your email, get on the list. That way, Santa will love you very, very much. Nass, welcome to the studio. How are you?
I'm doing very good, sir. Sunday, I did get this very sad news of Frank Williams passing away. Having followed motor racing since I was 14 years old, since the 73 season, when something like this happened, and I felt this way with Carlos Reutemann, you feel a part of your life leaving, you know. So I was very sad, and but you know, it's all cycle of life, and we will have a nice remembrance for him a little bit later in the program. Great, tremendous, inspirational story Frank Williams was.
Absolutely. I mean, a great loss to the sport and the memories, the history. I have to admit, there were some exciting times with Villeneuve. My goodness. Anyway, we'll get to that later on in the program. What we have here is a fantastic Grand Prix, and everybody's talking about what I've been talking about for years. And Red, you know, maybe I'm special, but this unbelievable speed from the Mercedes I have seen for the last four championships. And all of a sudden, it's the talk of the town. And I'm telling you, it's real. It's going to happen. And if you guys think that Toto is not going to have that thing on full-blown go, baby, and LCH is going to have a Mercedes that's going to be on 12, he's going to be giggling. And the free in-flight burrito is going to be outstanding. I'm telling you, we're in for Christian Horner surprise in Saudi Arabia.
Well, you know, the showdown in the sand is coming soon. Hopes are high in both camps. And by the way, at the Jeddah circuit, just so you know, they're not serving in-flight burritos except for Sergio. But they have for everybody else in-flight falafels. And that's very, very tasty also. But sir, this weekend may not decide the championship. There are situations where it can be. But I think it will set the tone for who will enjoy the championship ride in the Arabian Night in Abu Dhabi, which is only 1 week after the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix. As Chris Berman would say, the Mercedes nightmare could go all the way. Four in a row for LCH will give him one more title than the Red Baron. And Mr. Rogers, who would have thought this was even remotely possible when Machismo's teammate made his Grand Prix debut in Albert Park in 2007, that he will stroll to record heights in our lifetime. I never thought, to be honest with you. On the other side, standing in the way of championship number 8 is the Max Factor with an 8-point advantage. For him to become the first Dutch master of Formula One, he must win one of the 2 remaining races. The big unknown is the new stop on the schedule in Saudi Arabia. The Jeddah Street Circuit, from the mind of Herman the German Tilke, is the second longest track after Spa and the fastest street circuit. It will feature 27 turns and feature three DRS zones. So that's a lot of turns. The layout of the track is very nice, and with 3 DRS zones, and as I mentioned, somebody called it Monza in Monaco. I see some guys hitting wall of voodoo, caution flag, and when cautions come, sometimes you can be the lucky dog or lucky chihuahua and bark your way to race victory. Do you think we're going to have some, I'm not saying intentional argy-bargy, but some wall banging in Saudi?
Oh, yes. But the big problem is the Mercedes is going to be so fast. It's almost when you start analyzing the design of this track that it was really influenced by a Mercedes car, almost, that needed more speed. 3 DRSs! Let's give them 3 DRSs! I believe that Toto got a call from Tilke, and Tilke said, you could put your money on the Mercedes because this track is designed for you, Toto. I love you, Toto. That's my conspiracy theory.
Well, you know, plus Mercedes is bringing their spicy Samba winning engine from Brazil. So they have the speed. But, you know, Max is very good on street circuits. He's good everywhere, but he's very, he brings out his best in a street fight. So I don't think it's so, but momentum is definitely with Mercedes. There is no question about it. But then, you know, when you get put in a position where you have to win the 4 of the last 4 races, which both the car and the driver are quite capable of, but that means 4 perfect races, no issue with tires, no issue with pit stops. So it does add some pressure. And being a street race, Max knows. One thing I'm pretty sure, if Lewis wins this race, he will be 2021 world champion. So Max has to find a way to stop this guy from winning this race. And I'm not saying he's going to do something silly, but he's going to go all out to make sure Lewis does not win. And he really cannot count on his teammate that Perez will beat him and then there will be more damage limitation. And just like Lewis cannot count on Bottas, that Bottas is going to beat the hell out of Max in the race, which may happen, but probably not. So obviously I want to see both drivers finish both races and may the best driver win, no problem there. But I just have this, having this feeling that, you know, with 3 DRS zones, fast track, street track, and this is the first race there anyway, and I don't know if Happe Doss or Formula 2 are running, probably not. So I have a feeling that somebody may luck out where the caution comes in and they use that caution to make their required pit stop at the opportune time. And that may give them an unfair advantage, but that's all part of life.
Well, it may be an advantage, but I think it's completely fair. That's part of the circumstances that you're racing under. But yes, indeed, luck will have a lot to do with it. And it's going to be so exciting where Fernando is in the Alpine. Can he interrupt the love fest?
Well, can he be? Well, the race is in Arabia. It's nighttime race. Can he be Petrov of Saudi Arabia? Wouldn't that be something? wouldn't think about it. Wouldn't that be something? Lewis comes into for a pit stop, 15 laps to go, and then Nando does what he did in Hungary, and dishes are done for Lewis. But I don't think it will come to that, and I don't think Alonso is going to play dirty for anybody. But if his package is good, he will give him a good fight. And are you expecting anybody else to steal the thunder in Arabia by some magical performance?
No, to be honest with you. I think Ricciardo's got some serious problems. And because now he's flipped and is underperforming again. It's all about the Ferraris continuing to beat McLaren. I think we're going to watch Sainz and Leclerc do decent. Sometimes the Ferrari is surprisingly very competitive. That's going to be about it. It's going to be Kimi's second to his last race, so everybody's going to be emotional. There'll be free Haagen-Dazs for everybody. So, no. I mean, there's a lot of little things to be watching for. The end of an era over at Alpha with a whole new lineup next year. So, there's a lot of funny things happening. So, I can't wait. I'm pretty sure LCH is going to have this all buttoned up. He knows it. And his trophy maker is already putting on the second coat of whack. I'm loving it. Loving it.
And speaking of Ferrari versus McLaren battle, Ferrari has jumped ahead quite a bit in the points. But since the chances of rain are zero in Saudi Arabia, I am hoping maybe we can see Lando Norris on the podium. Wouldn't that be nice?
It'd be okay, but I'd much rather see Fernando get a second podium and really blow people's minds. Only in the food court.
Well, that is Yuki Tsunoda's domain. But you know, it would be pretty pathetic if Haas team, which started so very well in their first year, if they go without a point, they are pointless as we speak, if I'm not mistaken, right?
You are absolutely correct.
Yeah, that would be sad if they go a whole season, 20-plus races, without scoring a single point, despite having a Schumacher in the cockpit.
Well, and the Bank of North Carolina is going to be saying the same thing.
Yes, exactly. So we are looking forward to it, and first night race in Saudi Arabia. And I'm glad that I do like the track from what I've seen. The layout is pretty good. This is not the normal Tilkedrome type deal, and it has to be seen how it works out. I would like to see, Daniel Ricciardo. You know, Lewis Hamilton has a very wonderful taste in fashion. So I would like to see, who do you think would look good in a total Arab dress with the head covered and the black thing they have around, Lewis or Daniel Ricciardo?
Ricciardo, for sure. He's got the nose, you know. He's got that Lebanese-looking nose. He looks like Danny Thomas making room for Papa.
Yeah, I was thinking, maybe we can bring, it would be nice to see Daniel Ricciardo or at least one of the drivers dressed up in Arab garb and come to the track on a camel. That would be nice.
You mean a Lotus?
No, not that one. The one on four legs, not four wheels. The local Lotus. The normally aspirated Lotus.
Okay, now the mourning has begun for the entire Williams family and the team, Nas, the history. It's sort of a big one.
Yeah, obviously one of the great names in history of Grand Prix motor racing, and what a story it has been. Again, another great legend of the sport has now gone. Very sad. But man, what a great life he lived and what an inspiration he was. And that was before his accident in 1986. Like Enzo Ferrari, Colin Chapman, and Bernie Ecclestone, Frank started out as a racing driver. Actually, he was racing in a Formula 3 event in Denmark, I believe it was in 1968, in which Peter Revson's brother had his accident, fatal accident, and I think the track owner was also killed in that accident. Frank then started preparing cars for his good friend Pierce Courage. Funding was provided by family's Courage Brewing Company. When they were in Formula 2, an English journalist painted a not-so-rosy picture of his team while doing a season review of the Formula 2 championship. So Frank Williams wrote him a letter saying, You may think I'm a joke, but we are trying to run a serious operation here. And Frank was right. He was running a very serious operation, first from a carpet warehouse, then from a public phone booth when his line was disconnected for non-payment of bills. As a Formula 2 entrant, he would show up at races without having money to rent a car and then ask for a ride to and from the track. But the man never gave up, and that's why I admire him, always admired him for that. Tragedy struck in the 1970 Dutch Grand Prix when his friend and driver, Piers Courage, was killed in a fiery accident. The car, De Tomaso Williams, was designed by Giampaolo Dallara, the same man who designed Lamborghini Miura and whose company today supplies cars to Indy, Formula 2, Formula 3 and other series, plus of course making the Haas F1 car. Frank was also involved with Canadian oilman Walter Wolf, but it was petrodollars from Saudi Arabia in the form of sponsorship from National Airline Saudia that his team took off on the winning path. Frank was a great British patriot, so it was very nice to see that his first Grand Prix win would come at Silverstone in 1979 with Swiss driver Claire Regazzoni at the wheel. And Mr. Rogers, I am very pleased to say I was listening to this historic moment live on BBC World Service Radio. This race, if I remember correctly, was run on Saturday, and it was on the program called Sports Call. Jonesy boy from Australia, Alan Jones, gave the first world championship for Frank and Patrick Head, who of course was his partner and designer of cars. Then came Keke Rosberg in 1982. His only win of the season was in the Swiss Grand Prix, 1982 Swiss Grand Prix held at our favorite Dijon-Prenois. And then of course Frank employed two great characters who just could not stand each other, Nelson Piquet and Nigel Mansell, and both of them won championships for Frank. Then came Le Professeur, and Alain Prost could not win a championship with Renault, but it was nice to see him get a world championship finally with a Renault-powered Williams. Then we had Damon Hill and J.V. Jacques Villeneuve winning the championship with Frank, and of course you will remember Jacques Villeneuve started his Grand Prix career from pole position in Australia. So that was very impressive. So the team had basically 16 championships, seven for drivers and nine for constructors, and a total of 114 Grand Prix wins. Definitely one of the great teams and one of the great names annals of Formula One. Mr. Rogers, you know, unfortunately, because of his accident and our late entry into the world of Formula One, I never got a chance to do an interview or even meet him. But I was in touch with Miss Anne Bradshaw, who was the, who is, I think, still the PR lady for Williams and has been there for many years. And a few years ago, I had asked her if the European support vehicle can come into the Grove station and do an interview. And she basically told me that his health was not in a situation where we can come and do an interview. But you know, on a personal note, this is how I will remember Frank Williams. Do you remember back in the 80s they had this magazine called Grand Prix International?
Yes.
There was a long interview with him, and the subject of his hardship was brought up. You know, how he was always broke in racing and trying to sell this, trying to sell that, and trying to make it happen. And a comment was made, and honestly, I don't remember if it was Frank saying this or the writer, but the comment was made like they gave a reference to a fish that lays millions and millions of eggs, and maybe one or two will work out. And I always thought that was really his life. You know, the guy just kept going against all odds, and it was very nice to see him get the success he deserved. And then this next thing that I'm going to say is available on YouTube. There is an interview from some years ago. I don't know if it's 70s or 80s, but many years ago he was interviewed and they asked him about his passion for motor racing. And he said, you know, I've been a mechanic, I've been a driver, I've been an entrant. Motor racing is my life. And I would not even know what to do with my life if there was no motor racing. And that is my kind of chap. So our condolences to the Williams family and his friends and fans all over the world. And rest in peace, sir.
Thank you, Nasser. And why don't we take a quick break, and we'll be back after these brief messages.
Okay, I'm here with Alan McNish, man from Scotland, the land of Jim Clark and Jackie Stewart. Alan, welcome to F1 Weekly. How are you today?
Yeah, very good. Enjoying some Californian sunshine at the moment.
And coming from Scotland, you can use some.
Yeah, yes. I haven't lived in Scotland for about 18 years now, partly because certainly when I was coming through the junior formulas, it was a wee bitty far away from where all the action was. And I've kind of got used to some warmer weather and less rain, so I live in the south of France now.
Okay, you've been with Audi for many years now. You've enjoyed tremendous success, but this year you're getting a run for your money from another German make. How has the season gone for you so far?
Yeah, you're right. The competition level has increased a lot from last year and previous years as well. The other thing is that, you mentioned Porsche there. There's also Acura and Mazda on the odd occasion are sort of coming through to the fore a little bit. They're all in the LMP2 category. And in the American Le Mans series, the circuits are, I would say, more favourable towards a lighter car, even if it's got less power, and that's what an LMP2 is. And so it has made life very, very difficult for us over here for the outright victories. We've won class victories. You know, Dindo and I, prior to this final race, we've won 8 out of 11. But in terms of overall, which is the reason that we're in racing, then it has certainly been a bit of a tough fight. But if I'm being honest with you and totally flat on it, you know, we're fighting against the best. You know, Penske have got a great name in motorsport, Porsche, great history as well. And so from that point of view, Audi Sport and us, we're now, I would say, having competition that in some ways we deserve, because we deserve to be fighting against the best. And so from that point of view, it's been very, very good. And with the addition of Acura, I've quite enjoyed the sort of dogfights, if you like. And Petit Le Mans was one of the, I would say, the nicest races, because it was very clean. None of the, you know, none of the teams sort of fought against each other in terms of, in a negative way. It was real clean stuff, and the result was obviously quite sweet because we won.
Now, you have raced in sports car racing and in single-seater racing. Is the driving technique different when you're in a single-seater compared to a sports car?
I would say when I started in sports car racing, it was, yes, but now it's not. Now we've got a car with a lot of downforce pulling up to 4G in the corners, which is very similar to Formula One. In reality, the technology in our car is probably more advanced than anything in the world, including Formula One. And so from that point of view, we are, I would say, driving it absolutely on the limit and on the nose of the car all the time, much more than ever before. And the driving style is similar, but also the races now, because of the reliability of the cars, the races are just 100% flat out all the way. And this is the way I like to go racing, you know.
If you had access to cars which were equally competitive, which is more fun, open wheel or sports cars?
I enjoy sports car racing more, because open wheel now, with so much aerodynamic involvement, it means that you cannot overtake on the track very often. You have to wait to the pit stops. Even if you're 3 seconds slower than the guy behind you, he can't overtake because of the aero effect. And so from that point of view, with the mixed categories in sports car racing, it does mix things up. It means that you're overtaking someone every single lap, and even races for the outright lead, they can be decided because of a back mark on a slower car. And that just sort of throws another dimension into the mix that I really enjoy.
Going back to driving techniques, did you have to adjust your driving technique when you went to turbo diesel?
Not really. I suppose I had to adjust my driving technique more when I went from the R8 to Formula 1 than necessarily coming back. In regard to the going to the diesel, all we had to do was just square the corner off a little bit. Purely because we had so much torque and power, we couldn't apply the throttle in the middle of the corner so aggressively, which meant that we would brake more in a straight line, turn the car and accelerate straighter coming out. That was something that I would say was more of an adaptation than anything else.
Now, I believe you were second in the British Formula 3 Championship in 1989. When you did that, were you expecting, or did you get calls from Formula 1 teams?
Yeah, I won the championship for 6 months, and then we lost it in a court afterwards over some sort of regulation on where the starter motor was mounted on the engine. But I have to say that the winner now is David Brabham, and David and I dominated the championship. We won pretty much every round apart from about three between us. And whichever way it swung, I think, to be honest with you, it was a deserved champion. At that time, I was already contracted to McLaren in Formula 1 for testing, and so the calls came quite soon in that Formula 3 campaign. And then I tested with them and went on to Benetton, as it was. And then at that point, there was a big reduction in the numbers of cars on the grid, and I made a very clear sort of decision that I would go with Porsche and sports cars. And at that time, I didn't necessarily believe it would lead me back to Formula 1, but with the twists of fate and, you know, maybe being in the right place at the right time, the option with Toyota came up, and when it does, you take it.
When you went to Toyota, we were all rooting for you, and Mika Salo was there also. How frustrating it is for a good driver and talented driver like you to be in a program which is startup and has so many problems?
At the beginning of the program, both Mika and I knew that it would be hard. What we didn't anticipate was that the car would not develop through the course of the year, and any developments that came apart from one engine development would be negative to lap time performance. So, you know, the car we raced in Australia had been tested more than any other car on the grid, so we had reliability. So we could have a few good results at the beginning of the year, but then after that we did no more development, everybody else did, and they leapfrogged us. The frustrating part was I do not believe that any other driver combination could have done a better job than Mika and I. And it came down to the fact that it was their first year, and Toyota, to some extent, probably underestimated how much you had to progress in Formula 1 week to week. And that's the way it was. No negativity looking back. A little bit of frustration, there's no doubt. But no negativity. We knew to a great extent what we were getting into. Just as much as Toyota did, but I think to some extent they maybe just misunderstood the depth that it required to go to.
And I remember you had a huge crash in Japan. Can you tell us what happened there?
Yeah, I ran out of grip.
What happened?
It's 130R, which was just about flat. It's qualifying, I think, the third run. And I was about 7 or 8 tenths up coming out to Spoon, the previous corner. You come along a big long straight in top gear, and then you've got the just less than 90 degree left-hander. It's got a little bump in the middle, and as I hit the bump, the rear went down, and it just lost a little bit of downforce. The car snapped. I caught it, but then it snapped the other way, and I went off backwards about 190 or something. It was a big impact, there's no question, and a little bit bigger than I thought it was going to be when I was going backwards. But thankfully, you know, I'm standing here today. I'm still the same height as I was when I went into the shunt, so all couldn't have been too bad.
If I may ask, was your contract with Toyota for 1 year only, or did they let you go early?
No, I had a 3-year deal, which started in 2000. Started in 2000 and ran through to the end of 2002. So it came to the natural conclusion of that contract. The year in 2000 was very limited because it was testing with the GT1 car. The real year it started was 2001 with the test and development program with the Formula 1 car.
And That thing has really gone downhill. They have so much money, so much technology. They had Gustav Brunner when the program started, and this Mike Gascoigne. What do you think is the problem that this program is really back of the bus still?
I think Formula 1 is pretty difficult, and if it was easy, everybody would be successful. Just all motorsport is difficult in that respect. Personal opinion is that sometimes you've got to have someone at the top that gives you a real strong technical direction. And in 2002, that's what we missed. Gustav was a very good chief designer, but he wasn't the person to give total technical direction to the team. And so we missed that. And then afterwards, I think they brought in Mike, which was a really good idea. But at the end of the day, someone's backside's got to be on the line. When it works, they get the praise. When it doesn't, they get the boot. And they don't appear to have that.
Okay, tomorrow is the final race of the F1 season. Who would you like to see win the championship? And your thoughts on Hamilton?
Lewis has done a superb job, better than anyone would have expected, and no one predicted he would be going into the final round with a very strong chance of being world champion. Fernando, I think, struggled to come to terms a little bit with Lewis and the position he has within McLaren, because he's been there for such a long time. He's grown up with them, and I think a lot of people underestimate that. But Fernando, in my opinion, is a very natural successor to Michael. And then you've got Kimi, who to some extent is a dark horse. Kimi probably drives more on just sheer feel than anything else, but he's the one that sort of crept in the tail end very, very quietly. I think Lewis will win, because I think he'll just get out there and do what he needs to do. But that's only a small thought. If I'm being totally frank, I don't actually know. But, you know, if he does win, then it'll be a mega job. If Fernando wins, it'll be a mega job. And if Kimi wins, then it's one that he's grabbed on the blind side. To win a world championship, you have to be good over every single round, not just one or two. And therefore, everybody deserves it that has won it.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial and the king, the Swami himself, Nasser Hamid.
And yes, sir, this MM is electrifying. We will start with Formula E signings. First, the bad boy of motorsports, Dan Ticktum. He will race in this series, and so will young American talent Oliver Askew, who is from Florida, and we interviewed him a couple of years ago. He could not get a ride into IndyCar racing, so he's going to race with Michael Andretti, but in his Formula E team. Next is Monkey See, Monkey Do. MotoGP is following in the footsteps of Formula One and bringing its version of Drive to Survive through Amazon. Wonder who will be Gunther Steiner of Two Wheels. But it will be interesting, and I love MotoGP, so I look forward to seeing some good behind-the-scenes stories. Sir, Spanish Grand Prix, this will continue to race at Circuit de Catalunya, which is located in a town called Montmeló, not too far from Barcelona. And the contract has been signed with the help of the local government till 2026. The first race in Barcelona was in 1991, and the winner was Arnaiz after a wheel-to-wheel and cockpit-to-cockpit battle on the front straight with Mr. Ayrton Senna. Michael Schumacher's first win in a red car was here in 1996, in an epic performance in the rain. Have you ever watched that race, Mr. Rogers?
One of my favorites.
Man, if somebody wants to see how good somebody is in the rain, there are a few races I would recommend. This one, the 1968 German Grand Prix, where I think Jackie Stewart won by 4 minutes. And of course, Ayrton Senna's first win in Portugal, 85. But there was another incredible performance in the rain, and that was done by Nico Hülkenberg in an A1GP race in Malaysia, Sepang. So it really shows how good somebody can be in the rain. Okay, sir. Well, Mr. Rogers, you know, the Daytona 24 Hours is coming up in January, so I'm very excited. And then the following month is the Daytona 500. I'm waiting for Mr. Philip Pegler to give me a call or email or text so we can make some plans to be at the Great American Race as it is promoted. Next, Mr. Rogers, since you have worked at Arthur Andersen and also at Enron, you know numbers don't lie. Formula One is the premier league of motor racing. The score since the 2017 season in the Silver House, or House of Hamilton, as some would say, is Lewis 81 Grand Prix wins, Wingman 10. Bottas will cherish these wins. Next season, he will move to Monisha Les Sauber Alfa Romeo, where a top 5 finish will be a long pipe dream. His teammate will be the first Chinese driver in F1, Guan Yu Zhu. And speaking of Miss Monisha Kaltenbaum, who was a lawyer by profession, she took a lot of flack for the team's performance not to mention signing three drivers for two seats, but there has not been much uptake in the team's performance since she left the building. Despite Ferrari engines and Alfa Romeo sponsorship, they have become basically spaghetti culture number two. Would you agree with that, sir?
I do. They have begun to languish, and there were spurts of excitement with Monisha, but yeah, it's a sad state of affairs.
Yes. Okay, sir. Now we come to our Stevie Ray Vaughan segment, Cold Shot. One of your favorites, I'm guessing?
Indeed.
Thank you. In this segment, we look at drivers who went to the team garage or garage, and instead of seeing their race car, they were greeted by a U-Haul truck, and the welcome sign said, "We help you move." At F1 Weekly, good or bad, high or low, it's all about machismo. So we shall start with Nando. He is on the cover of this LP, which was released in summer of 2007. Much has been said about what happened, so I will pass on the nitty-gritty I call FIA details. An interesting part of the saga was, as reported at that time by Alan Henry, when Machismo and McLaren agreed to go separate ways, a meeting between the lawyers was arranged at an airport. Machismo would not come out of his private jet, so the attorneys had to shuttle between a Gulfstream and a Learjet. Talk about Rumble on the Runway. This album was released again in 2005 as Live from Suzuka. And Suzuka is where we go for our next case. And that also involves one of your favorites, Alain Prost. Le Professor lost his job at Ferrari due to a Big Mac. Not the one under the Golden Arches, but the one owned by Renault, as in Mack Trucks. At the 1991 Japanese Grand Prix, Professor described his Ferrari handling like a truck. This was said due to shock absorbers giving up. It turned out to be the final straw at the spaghetti culture. Earlier in the season, he stated he was doing two jobs at Ferrari, driving the car and running the team. And you can imagine how much fun the Italian press had. You know, what really pissed Alain Prost when he was at Ferrari, that they did a test session at Fiorano and he did not do any interviews. And even then he was quoted in the Italian motorsports or sports media that at this test he said this, at this test he said that. So about that, what do you expect? Next we come to Michael Andretti. On this side of the pond, Michael was Tiger on the track in IndyCar Series. Though he never won the Indy 500, he did win the IndyCar Championship, I believe it was 1992. And then with a lot of hoopla and fanfare, at a New York press conference, he was announced as Ayrton Senna's teammate for the 1993 season. Again, a lot has been said on his Concorde trip, so we will not go on that flight. But his multi-year contract was terminated early after Monza, where Michael scored his first and last podium in Formula One. According to published reports, McLaren wanted to put Mika Hakkinen for the Italian Grand Prix, but Mario Andretti called Ron Dennis and made a sort of a personal request to let Michael race at Monza for me. And if that happened, I'm glad Ron gave Michael the opportunity to race at Monza. So that was nice. Then we come to Alex Zanardi. In between his F1 stints, Zanardi became an IndyCar legend and a fan favorite. That success landed him a drive at Williams in 1999 with Ralf Schumacher as teammate. Season turned out to be a complete disaster. He did not score a single point against 35 for Ralf and was shown the door before the contract was over. Patrick Head thought he was not dedicated like JV and said, and I quote, "He still went into the motorhome and had the espresso and was full of jokes and laughs," end quote. Now, this is coming from the same gentleman who asked Heinz-Harald Frentzen after the German's first test session with Williams. And then the question was, I quote, "Are you sure you're a professional racing driver?" end quote. You know, some years ago we did an interview at Sebring with Derek Daly, who had driven for Frank and Patrick. I asked him what it was like for them because, you know, they're very strong-headed people. And his response was basically that their idea with racing drivers is, shut up, get in the car, or we got 10 guys standing ready to do the same job. Then we come to the case of another IndyCar champion who tried his luck on the other side of the pond, Cristiano D'Amato, one of many boys from Brazil who did well in junior series in USA, then did a great job with small teams, finally winning the IndyCar championship at Newman Haas. And story was the same with Castro Neves. D'Amato's IndyCar championship was powered by Toyota, and the Godzilla of reliable cars took him to Formula One in 2003. But there was no, oh, what a feeling, on the other side of the pond, and he was back in the USSA halfway through the 2004 season. Then we come to another hombre south of the border, Sergio Perez. Man from Guadalajara established himself as a bona fide driver, and race-winning driver, I should say. He came very close to winning the Malaysian Grand Prix for Sauber over Machismo a few years ago. The revolving door at Red Bull has finally stopped, as Sergio was able to do what no other teammate of Max could do, and that is win a race for Red Bull. In 2013, he was hired by McLaren as teammate to Jenson Button, filling in the shoes of LCH, who was heading to drive another silver car, but from a different team. Checo was fast and erratic and was released by McLaren after just one season. JB thought his new teammate was behaving like a honeybee, saying after the Bahrain Grand Prix, and I quote, "I've raced with many teammates over the years and with quite an aggressive teammate in Lewis, but I'm not used to driving down the straight and then my teammate coming along and wiggling his wheels at me and banging wheels with me at 300 kilometers per hour. I've had some tough fights in F1, but not quite as dirty as that," end quote. Do you remember Sergio Perez and Jenson Button having some issues as teammates?
Well, you know, I looked at it more as Sergio Perez just sticking it to Jenson Button, trying to prove his worth. And I thought it was all good and entertaining.
Yeah, I also enjoyed it. But it's like, you know, Esteban Ocon and Sergio Perez. It was getting too much at times. But we move on to Roberto Moreno. Known as Super Sub in IndyCar racing, Pupo, which is his nickname, also raced for many teams in Formula One. He was teammate to his teenage friend Nelson Piquet at Benetton. Then Flavio Briatore tried to hire a German driver who had the grand experience of just one Grand Prix weekend, which did not even include a full racing lap. Moreno was guided by a humble and low-key personality by the name of Eddie Jordan, which led Moreno to take legal actions against the team. Late night meeting with Bernie, Flavio and Jordan at this very famous Villa di Este hotel near Milano. This was going nowhere till Flavio asked Moreno to name his prize and drop the lawsuit. Cash is king from Parco Monza to Albert Park. Money talks, and Moreno walked with a nice payday with the usual clause in his settlement not to say anything to the media. And sir, finally we come to Kimi Raikkonen. Few drivers are lucky enough to earn $25 million to drive for a top Formula One team. Even fewer are lucky enough to be paid that kind of money not to drive in Formula One. And that was the case for the man of few words when Scuderia Ferrari wanted to bring in Machismo to Maranello. And the 2007 Formula One world champion went rallying and camping world truck racing. And like a boomerang, was back in the saddle to ride for Prancing Horse one more time. And that was today's cold shot. And here is the man himself, Stevie Ray Vaughan. Thank you for listening.
Good night.
Don't let our true love run cold.